Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And this is the new Not Alone podcast. That's right. That's right. We're here.
Visibly
here. So this may or may not make a difference. We'll probably end up publishing it eventually one way or the other.
Maybe a blooper reel, like a gag
or whatever. But we are recording audio and video. We are right now in our newly revamped studio, which is still my spare room.
You don't have to tell people that.
Well, I do, because there are also people who are only going to be listening to this. That's my concern.
Of course.
So for the those of you only listening to this, don't worry. We're not getting rid of the audio only at any point ever. But we are going to do this video thing. Now, if you're watching, you'll see we have this green screen back here. Jason has promised that he will transport us to a variety of locations using
it.
We're also going to plan on superimposing images, things like, you know, what we're talking
about. Actual reference material.
Would
be nice to actually see what we're talking about. Yeah.
It'll be a thing. And most importantly of all, this is going to help launch Jason. They're going to launch his career. He's going to be a famous YouTube boy from here on out. Me, personally, I'm happy staying in the shadows. I don't need that sort of... I don't like when people looked at me at my wedding.
I don't...
I was like, I don't want to be up here with people looking at me. But Jason has wanted to do this literally since we started. So how are you feeling, buddy?
It's coming of age, buddy.
You're pretty happy?
I'm stoked. This is going to be exciting.
Good.
I mean, there's going to be some... things to definitely work out and some kinks, but I feel like it's gonna be great.
I do too. Sorry, I didn't.
People can see me look at my watch now. Yeah, we have to actually.
They can see me idly scroll on Facebook when you talk for too long.
Same. That's the catch.
That's the catch.
All right, but
speaking... I wanted to do something special. I know that you want to dive in, but I wanted to do something special for our very first episode of our video show in addition to the audio show.
Again, we're not even sure if that's going to see the light of day.
It will eventually, and it's because of what I have here on my phone. Now, long-time listeners who really like us and really pay attention to what we do and care about us as people, and by that I mean they listen to the end of every episode, they'll know.
Who does that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't do that.
The last 15 minutes are usually just a wash. But you'll know that we always read a review at the end of the episode. We always say, hey, you know, thanks for writing reviews, and this is, you know, one of them. And I thought it'd be special to do that at the front of the episode. And the main reason why... is because of you, Jason Moitoso.
Oh, man. Who'd I upset now?
This review, we will not do this every time. We're just going to do it today because I think that your reaction, I'm hoping, is something that needs to be captured on video. This is by an iTunes user called The Fly in Your Protein Shake, which A, is very on brand for Jason anyway. But... I'm not going to read the title of it. I'm just going to read the review itself. So,
did I make something wrong? Like usual. I'm an enthusiast, not an authority.
The review goes like this. Let me preface the meat of this review with a starter salad. I love food-based reviews. We've had a few, and they're always a joy. Not Alone is a wonderful podcast, and I recommend it whenever I possibly can. I've recommended it on occasion more than once to the same person by accident, and once I recommended it more than two times to the same person not by accident. I am a woman on a mission, and I will break them eventually. Not Alone is a fun, informative, super interesting, and... Not Alone is fun, informative, super interesting, and the hosts are a hoot. I've met Sam in person, and he's just as rosy-cheeked and sweet as I'd imagined he'd be. Aw, just like Samwise Gamgee. He's got rosy cheeks. I have great admiration for this podcast because, as a fellow Boisean, it's not too often that something so rad captures a wide audience, and it makes me proud. I'm proud of you, sirs, and thank you for representing our state in such a fine way. Now... that was the first paragraph of this podcast.
Okay, that was a salad.
Now on to the main point. here, I'm finally writing this review because I'm ready to reveal to the world that I, anonymous iTunes reviewer, have a bit of a crush on one Jason Moitoso. I know. I too am confused about the events that have led to this state of being. It probably started with his voice. There's just something about that smooth low tenor, or maybe he would be a high baritone, I'm just making this up as I go, that intrigued me. I find his arsenal of random scientific facts impressive, but it's his humility and self-deprecation that's truly enduring. I've already revealed that I am a female living in Boise, so it shouldn't be a shocker to find out that I have just 2 degrees of separation from both Sam and Jason. We have many acquaintances in common, so logistically you could probably figure out who I am. I guess I'll just have to leave that up to you. However, if you are truly stumped and are curious about my identity, let me know on the podcast, and I'll throw a hint your way. Warmly, and then they typed out the shrug thing. You know, the shrug thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're like that. So, Jason.
The one that we have emojis for now.
Yeah, we do. So, there's that, iTunes reviewer. Sorry, I just want to make sure we're still recording. We are. So, Jason Moitoso. First off, I think I know who this person is. They're lovely. If I'm right. I'm sure they're lovely, good. Even if I'm not right. Jason.
Oh, boy.
What do you say?
I don't know who this person is.
Do you want to know who this person is? Are you interested in meeting this person and spending time with them? This is exactly why we did this. Good.
Oh, I'm on the spot.
You are on
cool.
the spot.
Sure.
Is that a yes?
Look at
the camera.
I don't know anything about you besides for the fact that I don't know what our main course was. We had the salad.
Oh, for goodness sakes, Jason.
What was that?
The main course was you.
Oh,
you were the main course.
How do I eat myself?
You're looking like a snack. And you can see that well now. So, is that a yes?
It's a hesitant yes. Sure. I don't know. This is... I don't... Let's get on with the show.
This is exactly what I wanted, and all my dreams are coming true.
I'm flustered. And now I'm not sure where to... continue with my life. Let's talk about the show and stuff. Orbs. Spheres.
I'll say that's a yes.
Circular things.
And we're gonna set Jason up.
Whew.
It's gonna be great. Okay, cool. Hello, everybody.
And welcome.
I'm yelling a lot because I don't have my headphones on.
I don't even remember.
We did
anymore.
Do the intro,
okay.
Yeah. So
I'm so
flustered.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going for.
Well, bravo.
Well, thank you. I planned that. You planned all of this with the lights and the green screen, and I planned that.
The ambush.
So anyway, we'll let Jason mull it over for the next hour and a half as we talk about an orb. But today, we're talking about an orb. One orb. A singular one. Now, orbs...
Is it a marble?
It's not a marble. It's been more compared to the size of a bowling ball.
Weird, because I think pinball.
It's definitely not the size of a pinball.
I don't know. But how are we going to describe it?
It's like a giant pinball.
Yeah.
If the Who, well, I guess they were around. I was going to make a pinball wizard joke. Probably too niche. In any case, I'm so bad at segues. After 2 years, you'd think.
In any case.
We're talking about a big ball that was found in the swamp.
Yeah.
And that's exactly everything I've ever wanted.
It's going to be a big, shiny ball.
Do you have anything to say before we dive right in?
Let's... No.
All right. Let's know, he says.
Let's just know.
No.
Let's wrap it up.
Let's not talk about it anymore.
Here.
Jason.
Sam.
On April 15th, 1974, a headline broke out. On the St. Petersburg...
Oh, no.
Shut up.
Here we go.
On the St. Petersburg Times, it said, "Just a ball, Navy. Not so, its finders." The story that
That's
ran...
That's a horrible headline.
It's really quite confusing.
Can we take a moment, reread that headline in a newspaper again?
As if, like, word for word, or what we think
No.
Be.
Word for word.
Okay. You can... I'll actually send you an image, and you can... superimpose it over this. "Just a ball, Navy. Not so, its finders."
Someone was paid to write that.
It could have been you. You could have done a better job.
And if that's the case, I'm sorry that I'm so mean. Anyway.
Now, the story that ran below was compiled by the compiled from the Associated Press and almost certainly featured in newspapers around the country. Now, this introduced the world to one of the most mysterious objects ever known, potentially. Or maybe
it's
not.
Wild. And this, I'm so excited.
This object is called the Betz Sphere. Now, the article reads as follows, quote, "The Navy says a mystery sphere found by the Antoine Betz family is only a stainless steel ball made somewhere on Earth. But the object's discoverers won't give up the notion that it's from outer space."
Okay, so that's a leap. A bit of a stretch.
I mean,
why is that?
If we didn't have any background, it'd be a bit of a stretch. But as we'll see, I fully believe that this ball is an alien drone. And I hope to convince you as well.
Well, I'm excited to see what you have.
Thank you. Now, the article goes on to state that the ball, which is 8 inches in diameter, and at first I thought that seemed small, but then I realized how big a pizza is. And that's not bad. This ball, which is stainless steel, it's 8 inches in diameter, it has no seams or marks on the ball other than a small triangle that's about 3 millimeters large.
Okay, so we have a really polished sphere.
Yes.
And a little triangle insignia on it.
Exactly.
Is it just etched in?
It's just etched in there.
Okay.
Now, this ball has been known to exhibit some extremely unusual properties. For one thing, it seems that it was able to emit both radio waves and a magnetic field. And according to a naval expert, the ball is perfectly balanced. And it had been observed moving on its own, sometimes even moving uphill. The Betz Sphere, as it's come to be known, has been proposed to be everything from a large ball bearing to an alien doomsday device, and everything in between.
Okay, so you're leaning more towards doomsday device.
I don't know that I'm leaning towards doomsday
device.
That's
a weird slider,
right? But on the scale,
yeah.
Go ahead and make a, in MS Paint, make a scale, put ball bearing on one side, doomsday on the other, and I'm probably right here. That's probably
so
where I am.
So closer to the doomsday.
Technically closer to the doomsday.
Okay.
If that's the only two options.
That's fair.
On this continuum.
There's got to be a lot of technology packed into this fairly small sphere.
Oh, there is.
Has anyone tried just cutting it open?
See, now that's the problem. If it is an alien doomsday device, that could be exactly what they want us to do. And then we could be dead. And then they could come and take over our planet.
They just have to wait like 100 years to do that anyway.
Not even that long. Now, this orb was first found on the Fort George Island. This is now an established cultural state park, but it's...
So where is Fort George?
Oh, fine.
Yeah.
It's in Florida.
There we go.
It's to the east of Jacksonville. Now, it's not a island in our traditional sense. It's more of an island like Manhattan, where it's surrounded by land anyway.
Okay.
It's not like it's out at sea or anything like that is what I'm trying to
it's
say.
It's more like in like a lagoon area.
I don't know
sense?
What
like
the technical definition of a lagoon is. Can you enlighten me on what exactly it means? I didn't think so.
I think it's just
who
like a,
knows
like
what
a
lagoon
really enclosed
is.
Enclosed bay area. Is
okay,
what my assumption is
basically, and this is where video is going to help us a lot. Imagine
this:
the shoreline of Florida, and then you have a little patch of land, and then around that patch of land is water, and then there's a bridge connecting that patch of land to the rest. Well, you'll just show a map.
Hopefully.
Like I said, it's not
maybe
really
I
an
won't.
Island. It's basically just one bit of Florida that has a narrow bit of water going all the way around it.
Okay.
So, there's that.
Cool.
That's Fort George Island. It is now a cultural state park. However, it has been a place of human settlement for over 5,000 years at least. And it has been all sorts of things during that time.
Such as?
Sometimes it's a vacation spot for the rich and the glamorous. Other times, it's been the site of a native village for the Timucua tribe. At another point, it was a massive plantation, complete with a large force of slaves.
That was not in chronological order, right?
No.
Okay.
That would be very strange.
Right?
That would be very strange.
Just making sure.
The marshy landscape gave a variety of options. However, on the day that our story begins, March 26, 1974, a portion of the area was being examined by the Betts family, comprised of, I think it's pronounced Antoine. It could be Antoni, but that doesn't seem right.
Let's go with Antoine.
I'm going to say Antoine. Antoine Betts, a marine engineer, his wife Jerry Betts, who is a very impressive lady that we'll talk about a little bit later on.
Okay.
But she ended up, she like ran for state legislature and all of that. And their son, Terry Matthew Betts, a 21-year-old pre-med student. Now, the family was surveying part of their 88-acre land that they owned, which had very recently been ravaged by a brush fire that came out of nowhere. You should put fire behind us at this point.
You really want this green screen to be animated.
Yes, okay. I want it to be all sorts of things. Now,
I'm going to put a still image back there and call it good.
That's fine, too. Now, this wild brush fire, there was no apparent cause that was found for it, no natural or unnatural cause, and the fire had spread extremely quickly. As they encountered the charred, blackened areas of land, something strange stood out to 21-year-old Terry.
Which, it does seem odd because we're talking about like a swampy area.
A marshy area right by the ocean.
Full of moisture. So, okay.
A moist place.
Suspicious fire.
If you were to make toast in this area, it would be moist toast. Now, there used to be. That's what we call Jason. And he hates it.
It's one of the many things. I hate them all.
Where there used to be a big, beautiful grove of trees.
I'm just going to have Bob Ross behind us painting trees.
Yes. Something strange stood out to Terry in the ashes that remained. Now, he found there, sitting in the midst of the wreckage, in the midst of the destruction, a perfectly round, silver, shining orb. It was about the size of a bowling ball and looked to have been completely unaffected by the fire. It had a polished look to it, and as we mentioned a moment ago, it was completely smooth, without any sort of markings other than this one triangular one, which was about 3 millimeters long.
Why does it sound like it's straight out of a movie?
It does. It really like does. But this thing, at the very least, exists. We have pictures of it. So, my goal is to make Jason's life as hard as possible. And I think I'm doing pretty good.
Well. Yeah.
Now, when Terry lifted the ball, he realized that it was quite a hefty little orb.
Did it not burn him?
No, it didn't. It not only did it not burn him, it itself was not burned. It had no scorch marks, no sort of abnormalities to it.
It's like it was placed there after the fact or something.
Kind of, but it seemed to be buried within the ash, as if it had all burned down around it and settled atop it.
That's okay. Right.
Atop. Now, he lifts it up. He finds it has a substantial heft to it.
Okay.
It weighs 22 pounds.
That's not bad. It's a good kettleball right there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there was no sign of where the ball had come from. It didn't appear to be marked or damaged in any way. And yet, there didn't seem to be any sort of impact from it being placed on top of the ash.
Okay.
It was, like I just mentioned.
It was like it was placed there and then
and
ash
then
accumulated
everything,
over and on
yeah,
top of it.
Okay. Everything burned down around it. Is the idea.
Okay.
In fact, inspected the area around the orb, not only was there no indication in the ash, there was also no indication of impact underneath as well, in the grass or in the dirt. It really just seemed like it just appeared there out of nowhere. Now, regardless of this impact, or lack of impact, at first they believe that they may have stumbled across a downed satellite, a la Sputnik. However...
And that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Sputnik was bigger than this, obviously, but who knows? There didn't seem to be any sort of antenna or any other components that they found on such an object. It legitimately just looked...
like a giant round.
Like a big old ball.
Yeah, sphere.
So they decided that it was probably, I don't know how they came to this conclusion or if people do this, it was probably a steel-plated cannonball that somebody had as a souvenir of sorts.
Why?
I don't know.
I just want an iron cannonball.
Yeah, why wouldn't you just
want
keep
it
the
be
cannonball?
Steel-plated.
Unless you're going to use it.
Maybe if there are steel spikes on it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And then you could throw it at people. That'd be pretty wild. Now, Terry... Okay. Being a 21-year-old man, thinking that heavy, shiny things are cool, as we all do.
They still are.
And they still are, and always will be. He decides he's going to take this back with him. So he carries the thing all the way back to their car. And as he did, he realizes he feels this faint kind of humming or vibration coming from the sphere, as if there's something inside of it moving around.
And that didn't startle him.
No.
Not at all.
Let's talk about Terry. Terry's a weirdo. Terry is the strangest part of this story. I'll tell you why right now. Terry takes this home and he puts it on his dresser. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
It's cool. You're living with your parents. You put it on the dresser. I just put that in there in the middle.
Wow, what was that? A jab?
For 2 weeks... It sits there doing nothing. And then, one day, Terry had over a friend named Teresa Frazier. At that point, Terry pulls out his guitar. They're in his bedroom. He pulls out his guitar, and he starts playing something. Probably Wonderwall.
Was that even written?
No. I looked it up. I realized it wasn't written at that point. I left it in the notes.
It's now, kind of man Sam is.
As
a visionary.
As he plays Wonderwall for Teresa Frazier, the orb starts to respond in some way. It basically starts coming alive, and it's like resonating with the notes that he's playing. And then it starts putting out its own notes as well.
So
as
it's
if
its hype man.
It's hype man. It's like some ecstasy-fueled raver who comes alive just when the beat kicks in. That's what this orb is. But what does that say about Terry? That this sat on his dresser for 2 weeks. He obviously didn't play his guitar or even practice for 2 weeks until there was a girl in the room. And then he was like, I'll play you some guitar. Here's Wonderwall.
I think that explains enough.
I think it explains enough. We've all known these people. Some of us have been these people. Jason is claiming he's never done this.
No.
Have you ever played guitar?
Yeah.
And you never played guitar for a girl?
No. Uh-uh. I played it, like, during middle school, and that was about it.
Why even learn guitar?
Well, see, here's the thing. I didn't learn it for very long.
That's okay. That's fair. In any case, I think Terry's a bit of a well, I'm not going to say the word, but I think we know what I'm going for here. We'll see.
He's that one guy.
He's that one guy.
In all the movies.
Now, according to Terry and Teresa, the orb began to vibrate like a tuning fork, indicating a steady tone, which then incrementally was augmented by some sort of a sonic pulse, which Terry claimed...
Well, that sounds fun.
Yeah, it does sound pretty fun. Again, it's kind of like a... Boonch, boonch, boonch. That's how I'm envisioning this. Terry claims this happened in response to certain notes, but he doesn't say which ones. So again, he's not very observant.
What notes are you using, Terry?
What are you doing, Terry? So, here's what's interesting.
Terry was entertaining.
He doesn't remember, or he never mentioned which notes it responded to. He also doesn't stop playing the guitar. Right?
He's probably just feeling it. He's like,
yeah, feeling it. It's,
I'm doing, what is that new sound I did?
It's like something in a movie. Like, I can legitimately see them, and they play a note, and the thing responds, and they're like, oh my gosh. And then he starts, like, strumming, and then it starts putting a note, and then, like, the camera does this.
And there's a laser beam that gets shot out.
Well, that would be neat. But the camera, like, turns around, and suddenly it's like, it's kind of like in Ocarina of Time, when you learn a new song, and you play just like six notes, but then like this whole orchestra swells behind you for like 3 seconds. That's what I'm imagining here. And it's great.
I need one of the orbs.
Yeah. Now, in another room of the house, the family dog ran under the table and started howling.
Well, you know, that makes sense.
Yep.
Dogs know stuff.
Yep. The dog was a toy poodle.
All right, never mind. The dog knew some things.
It refused to come out. At this point, the family starts doing rudimentary experiments on the ball, with Terry, of course, leading the way. Now, one thing that was clear was that this dog wanted nothing to do with it. There was one point when they forced the dog to stand beside it, which is just
Take a picture with it.
Take a picture
it's
with the ball.
There's your little bow tie. You look good.
It'll be on a Christmas card. They actually...
It is like a giant just Christmas ornament, isn't it? It's just a shiny ball.
They claim that they did it as a size comparison, but I don't believe that. I don't believe that
at all. I just want to take a picture of the dog with the ball.
Me too. And the dog put her head down and covered her ears with her hands.
Again,
well, they're not hands, they're paws. They claim they had never seen the dog do this before. They also don't tell us what the name of the dog is.
Okay, so it's probably pretty obvious that it's making some sort of really high-pitched sound that we can't hear, but the dog can.
Yes.
And that's why it's probably really upset.
I mean, that would make sense.
Who'd have thought?
Who'd have thunk it? Now, one of the most common phenomena is they started testing and doing some different experiments with the sphere was seemingly autonomous movement. Now, these experiments, like I said, thought up and led mainly by Terry, started on the ground, with the family pushing the orb one way or the other. The orb would always roll away from them, because that's just Newton's laws of physics, and then it would stop and roll back to them. Now, at first, this doesn't sound too impressive. If, you know, your floor is a little bit uneven, that's just what's going to happen. Right. However, it's been claimed that as they push the ball, sometimes it went straight out and straight back, but other times it would go out and then it would go all sorts of crazy places. It would make a big arc. It would sometimes, there was one point where they claimed it rolled for 12 straight minutes, uninterrupted, but it always came back to the last person who touched it. So that's pretty interesting.
That's pretty wild.
That's pretty interesting. Now, the movement wasn't only reported by the family, which is really important to remember. And when we're looking at stories, obviously we want somebody from the external taking
a
look.
Right, we want a third party. We want someone that's not biased and not trying to fib us.
Exactly. And so for this story, the first person like that is a man by the name of Lou Enger. Now, Enger was a photojournalist. He worked for the Jacksonville Journal. He was living in Florida in the 70s. So that's a pretty wild time to be alive, and a pretty wild place to be alive.
Now that you mention it,
yeah,
that sounds interesting.
He was pretty skeptical of stories about aliens and UFOs to begin with. Pretty much anything unexplained.
Went somewhere completely else with that idea.
He was like, I don't,
but that too.
I don't know about any of this. So when he was invited back to the Betts home in order to take some photos and try to figure out what's going on here,
right?
He was not happy about it. He said in his own words, I thought I was going to go and find a bunch of kooks.
Oh, did he not?
Well, he says he didn't, which is really interesting. He thought these were going to be weirdos and freaks. However, this is his report published in the Jacksonville Journal. Quote, I'm leery of this kind of thing. When I got there, Mrs. Betts said, you won't believe this if you don't see it. She told me to put it on the floor and give it a push.
Okay.
Now, it rolled a ways and stopped. So what?
Like a ball.
Like a ball.
Yeah.
She said, just wait a minute. It turned by itself and rolled to the right about 4 feet. it stopped. Then it turned back and rolled to the left about 8 feet. It made a big arc and it came right back to my feet. Unquote.
Okay.
That's pretty wild. That, so as we'll see, especially next episode, this is a two-parter. As we'll see next episode, people start to get involved, the Navy scientists, and some of the Navy people are like, well, your floors are just uneven. And it's like, that's not an option here.
I put this beautiful groove right in my hardwood floors.
I dug a channel.
When I push a ball, it just it settles in it, and it just goes right down the pathway.
It's perfect. It's perfect. Yeah. So another
great for water, too. Dust, everything just gets trapped in that little channel.
A common feature of such reports of autonomous movement included this presence of vibrating and humming coming from the device, as if there were some sort of internal engine causing this motion. Now, the ball, in some cases, seemed to be propelled by a kind of self-preservation instinct. For example, when it was placed on a coffee table.
Then why did it go into the middle of a fire?
Now, these are the questions we should be asking. It's placed in the middle of the glass coffee table.
Okay.
The glass coffee table is taken and tilted. The ball, as Newton's law would dictate, rolls downhill to the edge of the table.
Right.
I don't actually know Newton's laws. I'm just assuming. It then stops at the edge of the table.
Wait, you just assume anytime you're talking about gravity
and
Newton's
physics
involved? Okay.
Any sort of motion, I mean, is all Newton's law. Okay. I'm sure.
I have no idea how factual that might be.
I will be either justified or I will be either vindicated or vilified on either side. But, oh, that rhymes. Nice. But it rolls to the edge of the table and then it stops.
Okay.
And then it makes a right angle turn and it rolls along the edge of the table. And then.
So hold on.
And then.
Hold on. Hold on. I just want to make sure I'm getting this right.
Okay.
So it rolls down the edge of the table.
Here's the table.
It stops.
Here's the ball.
Yes.
Whoop.
No, I get that.
And
does the
then,
ball actively try to move up, or does it just sit there like got stuck?
And then it does this. Whoop, whoop, whoop. For those of us only listening to this and not watching it, you just missed a wonderful illustration where I showed that the ball not only came to the edge of the table and stopped, but then it traveled along the edge of the table and then moved uphill, took another turn, and returned to its original starting place.
Again, it's not trying to, like, climb up the side instead of falling down, right? Like, it's literally, it sticks in place. That's what I'm getting at.
And then it moves.
It's defying gravity by just sticking there.
And then it moves uphill. Then it
and
moves
it's a
back
smooth
up.
Ball without traction.
Yes. It okay. moves up.
Okay, no, I hear you. All of it doesn't make any sense to me.
That's fine. It doesn't have to. In fact, it shouldn't, because it's an alien ball.
Anyway, what else does Crazy Ball do? Because I'm sure it's multi-talented.
Yeah, so movement was a big one. The other one is if you shook the ball, according to Jerry, the mother, she said, if you shake, this is a quote, quote, if you shake the ball vigorously and then place it on the ground, it feels just like a huge Mexican jumping bean, which is trying to get away from you.
Man, I was really hoping to just tell you your fortune or something.
Yeah, that'd be dope.
you know, right where that little triangle is, like, try again later.
So again, you get this idea of some sort of internal motion where you'd put it down and then it would start hopping around.
It's like it's trying to right itself somehow.
Yeah, exactly. Again, it's trying to
recalibrate.
Movement propelled by this internal mechanism was a hallmark of the sphere. However, it was far from being the only mysterious phenomena that was associated with the object. Within,
well, yeah, it also is a background DJ. Lays down those sweet beats. Yo, he was just trying to help his buddy out.
For, what was her name? Teresa. Now, within days of the sphere activating, the family began to complain of some other truly strange experiences. For one thing...
Wait, it wasn't all great?
None of it was great. None of it. Now, for one thing, the family began reporting doors slamming day and night. Likewise, there were almost always constant noises in the night from the ball rolling around, hitting the floor, moving. The family took to locking it into a box when it was not being displayed to others. But one of the strangest things it would do would be to generate music. Now, the family began hearing organ music, which played regardless of if the sphere was locked up or not. This was reported in an April 12, 1974 article in the Sentinel Star, published out of Orlando, Florida. The family did not have an organ in the home, and no other saying other than organ music was reported, with no attempt made to identify what kind of organ music or to describe it any further.
Or record it.
If it was just cool. A random sound that, you know, maybe it's like three notes that played, or it could have been a whole concerto.
So it's like it wasn't even significant to them.
It didn't really seem to matter.
What?
There's a reason for that, as we'll see shortly. But what's interesting about this organ music, as you might guess where I'm going with this, is that it's in relation to a film that prominent ufologists, including our UFO dad, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, consulted on. That film, of course, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In that film, the theme of musical communication plays a prominent part with its famous five-note tone that is supposedly used to signal the arrival of aliens as a method of communication from the aliens to the humans, and then, at the end of the film, from the humans to the aliens.
So does that mean we have a copycat effect, or what?
The film came out after this.
Perfect. I thought it was, like, later on anyway.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. So that's really interesting to me, is that it wasn't influenced by that. We can guarantee it.
This musical trope.
Yes.
Got it.
Now, the idea of using a musical method of communication comes from the idea of using math as a universal language. As much as we all may hate to admit it, music is basically just math. Okay.
I mean, I'm sitting here thinking about it. I'm like, I'm not good at music, but I'm not half bad at math.
Well, maybe you're not half bad at music then.
Guitar tabs. That's all I did. That's all I ever used. That was my downfall.
Good Lord. Now, it's an interesting idea that in order to communicate with aliens, we could use some sort of a mathematic universal language. However, that would, of course, necessitate some sort of Rosetta Stone, translating our numbers and symbols into theirs. However, it's been suggested, both by movies and also by scientists, that music could work in a way that would need no such translation. The differences in frequencies that constitute tones could be used to create some sort of communication, and while I'm not smart enough exactly to know what it would look like, other people have put significant amount of thought into this.
So will we just be communicating, like, equations?
Yeah. Yeah, so one of the big ones, and I think this is from Carl Sagan's Contact, I could be making that up, though. One of the big ones would be to try to translate some sort of a universal a mathematical constant, like, I don't even know, I'm not even smart enough for that, but some sort of a universal mathematical constant, and then communicate it through the differences in intervals and in tones between. So if you have this at 1000 hertz, and then you have another one at 800 hertz, maybe you make that to mean either 1800 hertz or 200, and then you take that and you turn it into just a number, and then you add or divide. Again,
okay.
I don't know. Other people have thought about it. Other people say it can't happen. It's a pretty divided thing,
okay,
from what I can tell. Carl Sagan believed in it, I believe.
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that, again, we just have to use those numbers as a way to... We'd still need some sort of symbolic chart of what
right.
What.
Right, but if you could use the music in order to... If you could use the music in order to communicate the number itself,
right,
then we could show them our number, 200, and they could show us their number, glibzababorp, and we would know that we're talking about the same number. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So music would be the Rosetta Stone in that case.
Right, I understand that. But how do we translate numbers to real-world tangible things and feelings in events?
Yeah, that's true.
That's where...
Well, that's how you'd start.
Okay.
That's how you'd start.
See, you would not end there. Decoding it.
Yeah.
Decoding messages that are just numerics.
Yeah.
Into actual words.
No, you'd start with that, and then from there, move forward.
Sounds like a lot of work. I'll let someone else do it.
Yeah, yeah. Not for me. It's for the astrolinguists. Like that.
Is that a thing?
Theoretically.
Did you just make up a new thing?
No, that's the girl in...
An astrolinguist?
Amy, was it Amy Adams in... what? Why can't I remember the movie? It's like one of the best movies I've ever seen.
I don't know. Anyway, continuing onward.
Nope.
It's one of the best movies ever seen.
Denis Villeneuve, about the aliens that come and she has to like learn how to speak their language and then they...
Arrival?
Yes! Arrival.
I haven't even seen it.
That movie?
I got that.
You've never seen Arrival?
No.
Jason, we have to watch it.
Eventually.
It is so good. I don't know why I keep looking at the camera. The camera has betrayed us. Camera is dead. Now, this is interesting, to be sure, and could help point towards what might have been happening with this creepy organ music in the dead of night. However, there are a few problems with this idea of musical communication in general. Firstly, there's no reason for alien music to sound like human music, especially within this context of the Betsphere. There are problems with it.
Right.
There's no reason why aliens would have organs. There's also no reason why they would follow our musical scales. There's no necessity for alien music to be arranged into the same sort of intervals that can constitute things like our major and minor scales. This is even evident on Earth, where in Western traditional Western music, our scales consist of 7 natural notes and then 5 sharps or flats. This is only because we use whole and half steps in Western music. However, in the East, it's not uncommon to use quarter steps or even eighth steps. That is why Eastern music can sound so very different. Most of our Western instruments aren't even capable of playing those with any sort of consistency. Your like violins, your cellos are going to be really the only exceptions to that. I guess some of your like your trombones, trumpets as well, if you really knew what you were doing. But what I'm trying to say is, even on Earth,
our music is
vastly different. It's not just like, oh, it sounds a little different. It's an entirely different mode of music. So if it's aliens trying to communicate, why is it an organ? Why is it playing things that aren't recognized as patterns? You know, if it was a pattern, I would think that they said, well, it played the same thing over and over and it did that. But it really just sounds like random organ music. So
okay. So it's of this earth?
Is
that what you're getting at with that little ramble?
It could be. Or it could be that the organ music is not important at all. Those are really the only two options.
How close are their neighbors? Is it like suburbia?
Not very close, no. Okay. Fort George Island is a very strange...
It's not someone
strange...
just going ham on the organ across the street?
Okay. No, I went on the Google map and I explored. And it's pretty weird. It's pretty remote.
Okay.
Yep. Now, speaking of sounds made by the sphere, if you hit it with a hammer, which is what Terry thought was a good idea to do, the sphere would ring like a bell.
That makes a lot of sense. It's probably hollow. If it's only 22 pounds, that makes a lot of sense.
All right. If it wasn't hollow, how much do you think it would weigh?
At least 50.
Wow. You would know because you use kettlebells.
Yeah, and like a small kettlebell is maybe like 4 inches in diameter, and that's about 20 pounds.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, like they're pretty dense.
All right.
So I'd expect this thing to be just the same.
All right. Now, finally, one last phenomena which marked the ball was intense magnetism. There was only one spot on the ball which exhibited it, but it was apparently extremely magnetic and would even pick things up as it rolled along. One final interesting, if not bewildering...
It's just the beginning of the Roomba, isn't it?
It is. Or the Sphero.
Yeah, well, I was going to dive into that a little bit later, but okay.
We'll talk about it.
I know we will.
One final interesting, if not bewildering, aspect of the ball's activity is that it was not constant, but rather seemed to take place usually on sunny days, with the sphere being hardly active at all on cloudy ones. Obviously, if there was something like solar power involved here, that would make sense. And if the ball is truly the product of an advanced civilization, then it's entirely possible that it is.
What if it's just weather disruption of getting the radio signals? We already know that it produces radio waves. If it's producing and it's emitting and also receiving radio waves, maybe they're weak enough to where weather patterns actually interrupt it.
It could be. And if something is orbiting the Earth, it could be just that. Just so.
Because it's inside. It's not like it's getting direct sunlight anyway.
Right. Well, and it doesn't have any sort of a solar energy collector that we can tell.
Right.
It's just steel.
Steel.
Unless that's what the triangle does.
You need a lot more surface area.
You'd think. If you weren't an alien.
Okay.
But again, they are.
Right.
So that's the orb in a nutshell. There is more to this. Don't worry. We're not even going to talk about the Navy today. We're not even going to talk about the Omega Minus One Institute, which is a very interesting name for an institute.
What does their logo look like?
I don't know. I don't know if they have one.
Omega Minus One.
But what I find really fascinating about this orb and the way that we've described it so far, I've said it like a million times, alien, 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 extraterrestrial, whatever. It could be an alien thing, but some of the things that it's doing are not very alien at all. This idea of it opening and closing doors, this idea of it emitting strange human-like music or strange tones, strange noises, that doesn't sound like alien activity. What it does sound like is ghost activity.
It always comes back to ghosts or aliens, either one. If we start off on aliens, it's ending in ghosts.
Well,
if we start in ghosts, it's ending in aliens.
But that's what's really interesting about the Bette Sphere, is it is this one part of the paranormal where the two seem to it's like a Venn diagram that's just one circle. It is both alien and ghost at the same time. Now, the only thing that could make it even more ghostly would be like levitating, which unfortunately it doesn't do.
Darn.
I know. I was really disappointed by that.
Would that be ghostly or alien?
Well, again, it's
basically the same. They're basically the same thing.
And you do get like, what's interesting is you get, and we've talked about them a little bit before, but you get like channelers, right? Who like channel aliens and channel ghosts. So it's entirely possible.
That's really diversifying your crowd there. That's smart.
But that's the question. Do these two phenomena have anything else in common with energy things
besides, you know, the stuff that we can't easily explain from our common knowledge?
Yeah, exactly.
Like magic or something else.
You can't see it, but Jason is drinking from a mug that says, science, it's like magic, but real. So that's what he was referencing.
One of y'all sent me that.
Yep.
I forgot who, but I love it.
I think it was Katie.
Katie, you're great.
Now, to
surprise.
I do think the alien hypothesis is a little more interesting. It's definitely more titillating to me personally. And the reason for that, as longtime listeners of the show may remember, is that I had an experience where I was very young that I find hard to explain, wherein a sphere around this size trailed my family's van for a moment or so, and then it disappeared. I've always thought of that as some sort of like sentry put out by the ETs to keep an eye on things. And again, there's been no reports of the Bette Sphere levitating or glowing or anything like that, but it's not beyond belief that it once had the ability to do that and somehow lost it, thus causing the crash that caused the fire. However, we'd be remiss to pretend that all of this fits perfectly well into the ET framework. Like I said, there's a good amount of activity that could be poltergeist activity. The slamming of doors, the music, and even if you look at it that way, the movement itself could be a haunted movement as opposed to an internal mechanical movement, because that's very scientific. It's powered by ghosts instead of an engine.
But that does make more sense when you're talking about how it was able to stop itself at the edge of a mm-hmm. table and then kind of essentially walk around its perimeter.
Yeah.
Roll around its perimeter.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Now, there is one aspect of the Bettsphere that is often overlooked, I've found in my research, and was completely overlooked during the heyday, during the 1974 when this was happening. And that is their home. Or, should I say, their castle. What we've neglected to mention...
What?
Is that the Betts...
They lived in a castle?
Basically, the Betts lived in a deeply haunted home in the midst of a deeply haunted place.
Don't you even start with me.
As we mentioned near the top of the episode, Fort George Island has been many things to many people for many years. And it holds an ugly reminder of the ugliest time in America's history in the form of the Kingsley Plantation.
What a plot twist.
Yeah, right? I know.
I was not prepared.
I was delighted. The Kingsley Plantation used to occupy a sizable area of Fort George Island, clocking in at about 1,000 acres. It was built around 1797. Such was the size of Zephaniah Kingsley's labor force that it required 32 cabins to house everybody.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Now, Kingsley himself is a bit of an exercise in cognitive dissonance. He is a strange figure all around. He married one of his slaves, freed her, and then permitted her to own her own property. She actually inherited the plantation after his death. He armed his slaves, considered the African race superior to Caucasians in pretty much every single way. He served on the Florida Territorial Council and lobbied hard for the recognition of free people of color and to protect the rights of mixed race children in order to inherit property.
But hey, you got to get that free labor when you can, huh?
Well, exactly. It's very strange. He even gave his slaves padlocks to lock up their cabins and protect themselves and their valuables. Every Saturday afternoon.
Wait. Were they actually slaves, or were they slaves on paper?
Well, they were actually slaves.
Okay.
They were actually slaves. But what was really interesting about his plantation is that he used a quota-based system. So you had to do X amount of work every day. When you were done, you were done. You could do whatever you wanted. Every Saturday afternoon and evening and every Sunday, he just gave them off. And they were able not only to enjoy and you know, do their own, you know, just to hang out. But they were also, it seems, according to anthropologists who have studied the cabins, they were also permitted to worship any way they wanted. They were able to take some of the traditional African religious belief systems and play them out.
Wow.
On Zephaniah's plantation. So he was still a slave owner, though.
Yeah, but I mean, like, it sounds like it wasn't the worst.
Well,
setup.
He was a slave owner who entered into a sexual relationship with a human being that was considered his property. He bought and sold people. And yet, in every
it's
other
weird.
Way,
yeah,
it's just weird. He's just weird. And it just, I mean, I'm not even trying
think,
to like, I'm not trying
it,
to make a statement. I'm not trying to say anything. I'm just saying it's weird.
I think what it does say is how much societal norms play into that kind of role.
That's true.
At that point in time.
Yeah. Yeah. In no way are we trying to say like, you know, give him a free pass. He's not that bad. I mean, it's still slavery. It's just strange. It doesn't fit the mold of what I usually think, especially in Florida. But in any case, as one might imagine, no matter how well-treated individuals were, to have such a huge plantation is bound to leave some sort of psychic scars on the landscape. No matter how relatively well everyone was treated, they were still slaves, and there are bound to be a few ghosts on that island. Now, a few of the most common ones are Old Red Eyes. He was thought to be the...
Oh, good.
Yeah. He was thought to be the spirit of a man who was owned by Kingsley. He was hung by the other slaves on the plantation due to his excessive violence and force. It's said that He manifests as two glowing red eyes that are often seen in the rearview mirror as visitors to the plantation leave.
Sounds like an owl.
Okay. Anyway, there is also the ghost of Anna Kingsley, who was Zephaniah's wife and, of course, former slave. She is said to be, she manifests as a black woman in a white dress. Another ghost, the most famous of the house and the most intriguing of the area, is that of Tabby House, which is actually just down the road from the plantation. The Tabby House is just a shell of a house with no roof, no windows or doors due to the builder dying before its completion.
That's a bummer.
Yep. But apparently the ghost that haunts the home will change depending on who views it. If it's a good person who sees the ghost, they'll see a beautiful woman in white. If it's a bad person, they will see a wolf with eyes of fire.
That's such an arbitrary thing, though.
It's pretty wild.
So here's the problem with that, is we ourselves are our own hero in our story. Who judges?
The spirit. Obviously.
I mean, I guess.
It's just the Egyptian underworld all over again, man.
They went on vacation, I guess.
I love it. I love it.
Florida.
Now, all of this was said to occur literally just up the road from the Betts home, like within a mile or two. However, while the Kingsley plantation creates a big, beautiful, haunted backdrop for the Betts home, it itself is like a giant spooky X that marks the spot of haunted treasure. See, the Betts' 88-acre property was anything but modest, including the home they lived at during this time. Often referred to as a castle, the home was a lot more mansion than it was cozy family cottage. It was the product of an architect named Mellon Greenlee, who built the home in 1928 at the behest of one Nettleton Neff, a railroad tycoon from Chicago. The spectacular home took 2 years to build, during which time tragedy struck the Neff family twice. The first was when his wife died of a bizarre and still unexplained explosion at their summer cabin on Lake Michigan. The second was when their son was found hanging from an apple tree after disappearing from Harvard in his junior year. The death was officially ruled as a suicide, though a mysterious letter appeared days later claiming that Neff had been offered the opportunity to pay a ransom for his boy's life, but neglected in paying and led to his son's death. But this letter didn't appear, no letters appeared, until after the boy's body was found. Finally, in the winter of 1930, the house was completed, and the furniture was arrived that they were going to use to fill it. The mansion, however, was meant to be a summer home, and before the following summer could arrive, the furniture could be unpacked, and the family could start living in it, Nettleton Neff was found dead in the Railway Exchange building in Chicago of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. The house stood empty for years, and this is where a lot of really interesting stories come from, these 8 empty years
of the house.
So wait,
where's the conspiracy about all these deaths?
Well, that is true, too. I think the conspiracy is that life is hard and cruel.
That's not completely wrong, but okay. So there's no one like, ooh, someone planned all these murders in order to...
No.
Was the home bought in a mysterious way after the fact? Like,
no, again,
no?
It stayed empty for 8 years.
That's
because
so
nobody
strange.
Wanted to live in it. So you don't... I mean, you do technically have the opportunity for murder in each 3 of these deaths, and the deaths are historically true and accurate. They actually happened. Again, explosion, nobody knew why. The boy was missing for 2 weeks before he showed up dead. And
man, if only they sent their letters sooner. That postage gets me every time.
Well, that's the thing, is it was postmarked on the day the first one. So basically there were 2 letters. One was a ransom note. It was postmarked on the day that the boy was found.
Ah, so it's how I do Mother's Day and Father's Day cards.
Yeah. It's a little, it is a little weird that somebody would even, because they're obviously not going to get any money from it. It would have only been there in order to provide some additional guilt onto Nettleton Neff's conscience. And maybe that's exactly what they wanted.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about him.
To change the lead or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah. It is weird. If anyone knows about that, I don't know. Maybe you do, maybe you don't, but let us know.
Yeah, because we don't know enough, like, weird knowledge for some reason. Let's get more.
Now, during these 8 years, stories start to come out about the Betts home, also known as the Neff home, which it still goes by today. You can look up Neff House in Florida, in St. or Fort George Island, and it'll come up with that. It is in the boonies, which is its draw for people, including the Betts. However, while they had a substantial amount of space from their neighbors, they did still live within earshot and eyeshot of other people. And those who lived so close to the castle began reporting strange occurrences as early as 1931. One of those strange things? Organ music. Playing in the dead of night. It was so prevalent a phenomenon.
I thought we were talking about aliens today. I know. I really did.
I know.
I was not prepared for this.
I still don't know what I actually believe.
What are we talking about? You don't know what we're talking about?
I don't know what we're talking about.
Cool.
That's what's really interesting about this stupid ball, is that I really don't know if it's just nonsense and it's just a steel orb, or if it is a ghost or an alien or both.
So here's my call. As a visual metaphor, everything that we've been talking about was the fire and the ash that it was found in. And the ball is just kind of in the middle, the eye of the storm.
Yeah, yeah. Good.
That's my call right now.
I love it. Now, this organ music was so prevalent of a phenomena that a rumor even sprung up around the area that Neff's wife, who of course was dead by the time that the house was completed, was an accomplished organist. And within the mysterious home walls was a magnificent pipe organ that had produced the strange music.
It's all coming together.
Other phenomena was also observed, including fairy lights, which had been recorded as well in the pre-Columbian contact times by the Timucuan people in the area.
Yeah, that's pretty common for marshlands.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So don't worry about that one.
Now, the home sold and was inhabited for the first time in 1939 by Kenneth Merrill and his family. This did not stop the haunting. According to a maid who worked there, her name being Vera Chapman, the house would never warm up, even on sweltering Florida days. Fog would blanket the grounds of the home, drawn to it and neglecting the surrounding areas. She often felt as though she was being watched, specifically in one area of the house, the tower.
It's like my soul got manifested into a property.
Yeah, it's true.
It's beautiful.
This tower had a wrought iron Romeo and Juliet style balcony, because of course it did.
Yeah, naturally.
She also claimed that the strange fairy lights that were seen outside in the marshlands were also seen inside the walls of the home after dark. Finally, the Merrills ended up abandoning the home after 21 years in the 1960s, or in 1960, I believe. According to neighbors, it was a very sudden move. They had not told anybody that they were planning anything like it. And it went through a slew of different owners until 1969, when it was purchased by the Betts.
This is a lot like pretty much every haunted house we've talked about.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, the one in England?
Yeah, the rectory.
Well, not the rectory. I was thinking of the other one that had a...
The monk? Wow, we've talked about a lot of houses.
Yeah, we've talked about quite a few haunted houses. Probably, I think that's the one.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
the one in Pontefract?
Yes.
Yes.
Anyway.
It was Jerry Betts who first saw the castle, fell in love with the castle, and then wouldn't take no for an answer.
That a girl, Jerry.
She is determined. Strangely enough, there was a few instances of bizarre paranormal activity in the home with the Betts before the sphere arrived. For one thing, a telephone, which was a direct line to their closest neighbor, the Barnetts, would often ring when there was no one at home at the other residence. Also, there were quite a few unexplained broken dishes, including once almost their entire dinnerware set being found shattered on the ground in the middle of a dinner party, despite the fact that the cabinet doors were closed. It wasn't until after all of this history that the sphere materialized and began to exhibit even stranger phenomena. But it definitely bears the question of how, if at all, these things seem to be connected. This question, as well as the rest of our story on the Bet Sphere, will be the subject of our very next episode. Jason.
This thing's wild.
It's weird.
I thought
it's
we were
very
talking
strange.
About a robot.
I know. Me too. I don't know that we're not.
That's also totally fair. I guess we'll find out more next week.
What do you think? What do you have? Do you have anything?
So, of course, the way that you described the movement earlier, I was thinking because of where we work.
Right.
Sphero robots instantly. That right. explains why it was perfectly balanced, because it uses Spheros, are essentially a robo toy. They are a ball, and internally they have a motor, a couple wheels attached to a gyroscope. So it figures out where its balance is and always essentially stays true. And then I figured with radio waves, maybe it's using something like that in order to triangulate its position in some way, which that is also possible. Small radio transmitters known as, I have it here, radio frequency identification systems.
Okay.
They're used primarily on, I believe, cattle now. They're just a really small receiver system that allows you to essentially know your location, which is kind of cool. So kind of a precursor to GPS that we know. So in a very remedial way, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. The magnetism field, that kind of happens anytime you put a current through a coil. So again, being so small internally, that makes a lot of sense. What doesn't make a lot of sense is where it's getting its power.
Yeah.
The power is the problem that I have with it. Because when we're talking about something so small, to have that much power, it seems pretty impossible, especially back in 74.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is all of this stuff that you're talking about, I guess it's all possible for 74, but it seems like it would have been a little advanced even for the time, or for any just normal person to have access to, I guess.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't understand that.
That's fair. That's fair.
Otherwise, everything else kind of checks out, besides for the organ music.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, that's about it. Like, otherwise, it all makes sense.
Which, again, who knows where that organ music is coming from. If it's, because it is recorded as happening before the sphere.
Right.
And then it is also recorded in the whatever sentinel as happening concurrently with the sphere. But it does not mean that it is coming from the sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
design-wise, I don't really think the sphere makes a lot of sense for a little rover either, because it's perfectly smooth.
Yeah.
That doesn't add a lot of traction if you are wanting this thing to move around a lot.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make any sense. So I'm really curious to see what we're actually going to dive into.
Yeah. It's going to be wild. I don't know what I think about. I don't know what I believe about this sphere. But it's something else. We are not going to go anywhere near in depth with this, and maybe I shouldn't even, I don't know, it feels a little weird to mention it. Astonishing Legends did a 12-hour series on this damn ball. So.
How?
Yeah.
I mean, we ramble.
Yeah.
But that's,
it was like four episodes, I think. Part of them, I think they even interviewed the Betts. The surviving Betts. So, in any case, if you really want to dive deep, you could do that. We are not going to go that deep. But that does bring up another important point, which is that the Betts never... It's hard to say. Technically, they did seek money for this, which we will talk about next time. It was not their idea, though. And other than one attempt that they were not very happy to do in the first place, nobody wrote a book. There was never a movie. It's not a Whitley Strieber sort of situation, you know? But.
Wait, are you saying Whitley Strieber did it for the money?
No, I'm saying that Whitley Strieber made money. I'm not saying that's why he did it.
Okay.
I'm definitely saying that it does not help his case. But we'll just have to see. I am really. It's really a fascinating intersection between all sorts of things. So we'll talk more about that next week. In the meantime, we do have some people that we'd like to thank, unless Jason, you have anything else?
I think that's it. I think we're just on a wild ride.
Yeah, we are. So, of course, we read the interview, or not the interview, we read the review at the top of the episode. Jason, do you have any more firm of a statement you'd like to make on that, or you're still just gonna flounder?
I am both Flattered and floundered.
Basically, this is what I'm asking. Jason, will you agree to a blind date with this person?
I don't know.
Damn it, Jason. You have 2 weeks to decide.
I don't like that concept.
I know you don't, because you're scared. You're scared of love.
I'm scared of everything.
Human emotion.
Yeah, that's scary.
Anyway, so we'll let Jason think about that. But we do have some other people we'd like to thank who also wrote reviews. We would like to thank Beachlord Thrashfelon. Holy
nice.
Goodness. What a name. Whew, that is fantastic. Thank you, Beachlord. We'd also like to thank Tig12 and Ragrogue. Ragrogue, that's it. These are all some very good names.
Man.
And then again, of course, we'd like to thank the Fly in Your Protein Shake. Jason will eventually say something more or less or nothing at all.
I don't think I can say less.
You really can't. Other than that, we got, I want to say, one new patron. Let me check.
Oh, boy.
Hell, I can't. There we go. Next time, we're going to have... How much does a backup battery cost?
I have no idea. I'm going to talk to Jeremy a little bit more.
Yeah, figure some stuff out.
I'm using my brother's camera because he told me it would do the trick.
But this is actually good because now you have half an episode with a lot of opportunity
to
put stuff in.
Yeah.
And so next time we'll be ready. So we just have one new patron and that new patron is Jessica Leach. Woo! Jessica, thank you so much for supporting the podcast. You can always take a look on patreon.com/notalonepodcast to learn more about supporting the show. It's that sort of support that has led us to being able to move to video. And it also helps us literally keep all of these lights on that you will see when we do this. So, we're just very humbled and grateful for that. So, other than that, this is actually going to be a little bit of a shorter episode, it looks like. We're only at an hour 23 right now. Once we edit out all of the starting and stopping and gaffes, it'll be like an hour 15.
That's closer to the hour time point we want.
Yeah, it is. It truly is. All right, well,
cool.
You can find us on Facebook at Not Alone Podcast or join our Facebook group. Remember, we are not alone, a community for the strange. You actually can't. Maybe you will be able to. I am not currently renewing our website because I'm thinking of having one of our friends build us a new website. So notalonepodcast.com may or may not be there.
Is he the newly Americanized
yes.
one? Okay.
Yes, our new All fellow right. citizen. We need to talk about specifics there, but he does a real good job. So there may or may not be notalone.com, notalonepodcast.com right now. Deal with it. You can also find us on Twitter at notalonepod. You can find me on Twitter at beerlordelfbane, and you can find Jason on Twitter at
mightymoit.
And we do have an Instagram.
Do we?
Which we posted last. Let me see. The last time we posted on the Not Alone Instagram is...
Seeing that, you have to look it up. Too long. It is basically a ghost town.
August 23rd, 2018. We've got
so
a year. Without posting on Instagram.
So don't worry about
it. Don't go there. And yet people still follow us.
That's strange.
We still get new followers.
I appreciate the support.
It's pretty wild. In any case, we love you all. Let's see. So the last episode.
I did it.
You did it?
Yes.
You're sure?
Mm-hmm.
100%?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm evens, your odds.
Yeah, I can't remember if this was an odd or even episode. That's the problem.
An odd.
Well, that's just rude. Well, that means I'll do it.
Yeah. Let's see what you got, buddy boy.
let me warm up the throat. There.
Hey, well, you've been talking for like an hour and a half.
Remember, whether you find a mysterious alien object sitting among the ash that used to be your life, or you find a mysterious haunted object sitting among the ash that used to be your life. You are not alone.